Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Afghans vote for a new president amid Taliban threats. Ukrainian military personnel shot out of the sky. And Iraqis answer a revered cleric's call to defend the country. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Afghans went to the polls today to vote in a second round of presidential elections. The Taliban has vowed to violently thwart the election, and violence did begin early. But as Sharon Bain reports, it didn't seem to stop anyone who wanted to vote from going to the polls.
By mid-morning, there was a steady stream of voters in the capital. For those who did turn out, such as Haji Gholam Jilani, the chance to vote was too important to miss. He says, this election is important, not just for me, but also for the future of my children. Minister of Interior Mohammed Omer Dawoodzai warned that the threat of militant violence was high.
But we have gained far more experience. And we are also in a much better position to prevent any possible attack by terrorists.
UN Special Envoy to Afghanistan, Jan Kubisch, said it was up to local monitors to ensure a clean election.
International observers can only complement the effort of the domestic observers.
Sharon Bain, VOA News, Kabul.
Ukraine's prosecutor general's office says pro-Russian separatists shot down a military transport plane, killing everyone on board. The office said 40 service members and 9 crew died early today when rebels shot down the Ukrainian Air Force Ilyushin 76. The prosecutor's office said a criminal investigation has been opened under anti-terrorism laws. On Friday, the U.S. State Department confirmed Russia sent at least 3 tanks and other heavy weapons to separatists in Ukraine, with NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen saying this marks a serious escalation of the Ukrainian crisis. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is vowing to fight and defeat Sunni militants who have captured large chunks of northern Iraq and are moving toward the capital. Shelling and other sounds of fighting could be heard in the regions north of Baghdad today. Hundreds of Iraqi young men are flocking to volunteer cities, centers across the city in Baghdad and elsewhere to join the fight against the Islamist militants who have advanced across the north this week. The volunteers are responding to a call to arms from Iraq's most revered Shiite cleric, as Henry Ridgewell reports for VOA from London.
The speed of ISIL militants closing in on Baghdad has shaken Iraq and its allies. ISIL draws strength from anti-government feeling among Iraq's Sunni population. Thousands of civilians, mainly Shias, are arriving at recruitment centers in Baghdad to volunteer to fight the militants. Iraq's most revered Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, issued a call to arms Friday.
We call on all citizens who can carry weapons and fight the terrorists in defense of their country, its people, and its holy sites to volunteer and join the security forces.
Iraq's Sunni Shia divide threatens to erupt into civil war. A return to the darkest days of sectarian bloodshed would provide a fertile recruiting ground for extremist groups like ISIL. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Day 2 of World Cup action is just getting underway. On Friday, the games began with the Netherlands crushing the defending champions, Spain, which was also the top-ranked team. They won by 5-1. Mexico outplayed Cameroon and Chile trounced Australia. In the host country, Brazil, which is famous for its parties and hospitality, World Cup fans seem to be having a wonderful time.
Everyone's been friendly. The first night I ate with 4 Austrian guys. Today I ate lunch with probably 9 Argentinians. I came here alone, and everyone's just been extremely friendly.
We just get the feeling now, so it's nice. The first game we watched in a small bar at the beach, so I thought for this event, Holland playing, we will go here.
Coming up today, Colombia versus Greece, Uruguay versus Costa Rica, England versus Italy, and the Ivory Coast versus Japan. The Los Angeles Kings have reclaimed the National Hockey League title with a 3-2 double overtime victory over the New York Rangers in Los Angeles last night. Los Angeles wins the series 4-1. This is the Kings' second NHL championship in 3 years, and they were celebrating hard in L.A. last night. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening. It's Saturday, June 14th. Welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
One out of every 25 violent deaths in the world are caused by law enforcement officials. In some cases, of course, justifiably so.
A UN official calls for the urgent reform of laws and the use of lethal force by police.
We are still seeing the elephant populations in decline, which means that the levels of illegal killing are exceeding the natural birth rate. So overall, the population of the African elephant is in decline.
The impact of poaching on the decline in elephant populations in Africa.
I'm worried and I'm afraid as well. If they deport me in this situation, I'm afraid.
And South Africa tightens its immigration laws. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
A UN special investigator is calling for the urgent reform of laws on the use of lethal force by police. In a report to the UN Human Rights Council, he notes the police too often abuse the extensive powers they are given. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN special investigator Christoph Haines said... 3, 2, 1. UN Special Investigator Christoph Haines is calling on governments around the world to launch a campaign to bring the laws of all states into line with international standards. He notes too many laws on the books were enacted more than 100 years ago. In African and Caribbean nations, he says many colonial laws are still in place. He says they still come from the British Riot Act of 1714 or the French Law of 1848.
Essentially, it says that if 12 people are gathered and they refuse to disperse when told to do so, law enforcement officials may shoot with impunity. Or in the case of the former French colonies, many of them, there must be 3 warnings with a drum. And if people don't disperse, then the police may use firearms.
Hines says these laws, which stem from the pre-human rights era, must be made relevant to the contemporary world. He says they do not offer protections for demonstrators who may clash with the police, as happened in Tahrir Square in Egypt. He notes laws governing protests in Egypt hark back to the colonial era of 1914. He says the extensive powers enjoyed by the police can be easily abused in any society around the world. He tells VOA statistics show how dangerous the excessive use of force can be.
One out of every 25 violent deaths in the world are caused by law enforcement officials. In some cases, of course, justifiably so. It is their duty to protect people. In some cases, they can't do so without using force. But the overall figure is that in 2011, which is the last date for which we had the figures, this is worldwide, that 21,000 people were killed by law enforcement official of an overall estimate of around about 500,000 violent deaths in the world.
Hines says in most societies, police who use excessive force tend to justify their actions by claiming they are fighting terrorism. He says demonstrators who are killed often are branded as terrorists. The UN investigator does not deny the importance of countering terrorism, but he says this becomes an easy justification for the use of deadly force, especially in states that lack a proper system of accountability. He says it essentially becomes a license to kill. He says lethal force by the police can be reduced if laws are put in place that accord with international standards. He says police must be trained in proper crowd control. Finally, he notes police who are given equipment to protect themselves from potentially violent protesters will feel less threatened and will not be so quick to shoot. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
African Union Commission Chair Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma says Africa has made significant strides, but there is still more to be done. She says while much has been achieved in agriculture, she's concerned about the decline in industrialization in many African countries and presses on governments to prioritize this as a way of alleviating poverty and improving people's lives. Dlamini-Zuma was in London for the Global Summit to End Sexual Conflict, where VOA's Sandra Nyara reached her.
We are going to work with our member states to make sure that the policies are in place, that there are systems, especially the judiciary, the social systems to support the victims when it has happened, policies and programs to prevent and to protect. So we are going to be looking at all that. But in the long term, it's also important to look at the status of women in society, because I think until we address the status of women in society, we will find that these brutal acts will not stop. So it's important to bring a generation from school, beginning to teach kids at school against sexual violence, but also to respect women, to respect girls, and to treat them as equal human beings. Then once that generation comes through, then we probably have less of this than we have now.
As some of the sexual violence that has been recorded in Africa was attributed to peacekeepers, what is the continent doing in trying to address this issue and making sure that those who are sent in to save women, to save lives, do not end up sexually abusing women and girls?
It's something that we've been looking at already, especially around peacekeeping to start with, trying to see what we can do and the international community can do. For instance, just simple things in the camps. Some of the camps don't even have lighting inside their tents and outside. We are already training peacekeepers to know that sexual violence, we have zero tolerance for it, but more importantly, that they have a responsibility to protect the women against sexual violence.
Now, at the end of the conference, you obviously are going to come up with a number of resolutions on what needs to be done to end sexual violence in conflict. As the chairperson of the AU Commission, what more needs to be done in terms of making sure there's that political commitment and concrete actions on the ground in Africa to deal with this issue?
It's a number of things. One, it's the training of the soldiers. I think we must train the soldiers and the police so that it's really in the very essence of their training, is part of their culture, is part of their doctrine, that they do not abuse women. And we must get a lot of women into the defense force, into the police, so that they can also go up in the hierarchy, so that they can bring a different perspective to policing, a different perspective to the defense force. I also think we must ensure that the laws, if somebody perpetrates these crimes, is brought to book, that the law takes its course, so that people know there is a price to sexually abusing anyone. And of course, we also, as women, need to work with young people. I think we need to work in the social networks, in all the young people circles, to show them that it's not cool to abuse a woman. And I think in government generally, we should bring more women ministers. There should be a critical mass of women in all sectors, in government, in the judiciary, in the academia, in various places, so that the perspective of women in life is integrated with everything.
How have you seen the conference? How is it in terms of being progressive in trying to find ways of trying to deal with ending sexual violence in conflict?
It's very interesting. There is a lot of energy because, as you know, it's not just governments. It's governments, it's civil society, it's women, it's a whole range of people who are here in huge numbers. Even young people are here. There is a lot of positive energy around this subject. We hope that we can not lose this momentum because it has generated a lot of momentum. But I think we should also warn that this is not something that can be achieved in a short space of time. We need to work a lot now to achieve some of the things in the short term, but understand that this struggle is a marathon. It's not just a sprint. It will take a long time because in the end, you have to change society.
African Union Commission Chairperson Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma on the line from London with Sandra Niera of VOA's Zimbabwe service.
Meanwhile, a major wildlife conservation group reports more than 20,000 African elephants were poached across the continent last year. CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species on Wild Fauna and Flora, warns that poaching contributes to the continuing decline in elephant populations. Again, Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
According to CITES, 2013 was the third year in a row more than 20,000 elephants have been killed across the African continent. It says the sharp upward trend in illegal elephant killing observed since the mid-2000s peaked in 2011 and is leveling off. But CITES Secretary General John Scanlon says poaching levels remain alarmingly high. He says Africa's elephants continue to face an immediate threat to their survival from high levels of poaching for their ivory.
We are still seeing the elephant populations in decline, which means that the levels of illegal killing are exceeding the natural birth rate. So overall, the population of the African elephant is in decline. However, the upward trends we saw that became very sharp in 2010 and 2011 in terms of the levels of illegal killing have started to level off, but at a level that is far too high. Namely, we still have over 20,000 African elephants killed per year.
The CITES report shows an increase in the number of large seizures of ivory made in 2013. For the first time, the conservation group says more smuggled ivory was seized in Africa than in Asia, where the market for the illegal product is huge. It says three African countries, Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda, account for 80% of those seizures. Scanlon says the large scale of the ivory seizures indicate transnational organized crime and rebel militia are involved in the illicit ivory trade. He says this demands a stronger, more concerted response from the international community.
This is a serious crime. It needs to be treated as a serious crime, and we need to deploy the same sorts of techniques that are used to combat other serious crimes, such as illicit trade in narcotics or human trafficking or illicit trade in arms. At one point of time, a seizure was seen as a success under CITES. What we're saying, a seizure is not a success. I mean, it's important, it's a critical part of the process. You have to go beyond the seizure, and you have to go beyond the seizure to find actually who was at the end of that, who wanted that in the first place, who ordered it, and how do you catch them?
CITES monitors 51 sites across Africa to keep tabs on illegal killing of elephants. It finds the greatest increase in poaching was in Zanga Sanga in Central African Republic. On the other hand, it says poaching levels decreased substantially in parks in Chad, Zimbabwe, and Uganda. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
4 years ago, the South African government granted amnesty to hundreds of thousands of Zimbabweans who'd fled to that country seeking asylum from political violence at home. But now, the Pretoria government is tightening its immigration laws, a move which could make it difficult for many Zimbabweans to remain. For VOA, Tuso Kumalo has more from Johannesburg.
The turmoil in Zimbabwe over the years has forced huge numbers of Zimbabweans, like these women selling items on Johannesburg streets, to flee into neighboring South Africa. Some officials estimate that 2 million Zimbabweans now live in the country. But life here has not been easy. Those who fled political violence have to line up for days, sometimes even at night, to apply for asylum. Many of these immigrants say tough new immigration laws have made their lives difficult. Under the new laws announced in May, some 300,000 Zimbabweans who were given amnesty permits are now required to return home to extend their visa. Zimbabwean immigrant Dorcas Mero, who is now bedridden after a serious road accident, says the new law has brought her life to a standstill.
I'm worried and I'm afraid as well. If they deport me in this situation, I'm afraid.
Her husband, Gifty Niza, who was injured in the same accident, is in a similar predicament.
I'm very bitter about these new laws, and I think the new Minister of Home Affairs have to revisit and engage the people and ask the people about their problems.
Bishop Paul Verin of the Central Methodist Church in Johannesburg compares the new immigration laws to those from South
and
Africa's discriminatory past.
But it feels as if we're dealing with the same kind of complications as we dealt with the past laws in the old apartheid era.
These immigrants say their fate is now in the hands of the South African government. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
At least half of Kenyan university graduates lack skills, technical mastery, and work-related capabilities. The implication is that despite the increase in university enrollment in previous years and the fact that thousands of young Kenyans are graduating each year, their qualifications are not enough to secure jobs. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
In the last decade, as the number of universities in Kenya has increased, so has the number of students. The result is tens of thousands of graduates enter the job market each year and are unable to find work. A new report from the Inter-University Council for East Africa blamed the situation on poor training at the universities, which it says do not have enough quality teachers to instruct the ever-increasing number of students. According to employers interviewed for the report, most graduates lack self-confidence, communication skills and practical expertise required in the jobs they are seeking. The report also found many employers in East Africa are shunning new graduates in favour of already experienced and highly skilled workers. Jamlek Njoka, a University of Nairobi official in charge of graduate employment, defends the quality of education delivered by the school. He says today's graduates are better than the previous ones.
I believe that the quality of training for today's graduate is even better. But having to train a lot of the graduates, you may realize that a few may not be well prepared for this. But I would say that today's graduates are better placed and they are more exposed.
Njoka says many students finish their studies without completing an internship, a key part of the program.
There is less exposure for our graduates because when we talk about practical work, you know, we expect that the graduates, in the course of their studies, they'll go out and they work there in the industries and work also in the offices through internships and attachments. But you find that there are a lot of graduates who leave university having not gone for this practical experience.
Students in Nairobi who spoke to VOA remain optimistic about their employment prospects, with several focusing on becoming entrepreneurs. 21-year-old David Njoroge, a business student at the University of Nairobi, says he will not apply for the office job sought by so many graduates.
For me, I'm not into white-collar jobs. And currently, I can see the white-collar jobs are much more pursued by many people, and I want to start to venture in my own business.
Another student, Beryl Osongo, says more students should start their own businesses so that in the future they can also become employers.
There's no jobs. Because most of the students, they're waiting for the ready-made things. Like, I think people should start investing so that they create enough jobs for each and every person. I think the students should just be creative to start their own jobs.
The official unemployment rate in Kenya stands at 40%, with rates running even higher for people between the ages of 15 and 35. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
China gets a lot of the blame for buying the ivory taken from Africa's dying herds of elephants. But conservationists and government officials in Washington say America is also a big market for illegal ivory. But observers say President Barack Obama seems determined to see the U.S. play a role in saving Africa's declining elephant population. VOA's William Eagle reports.
China embarked this year on a major campaign to persuade ivory lovers to get out of the habit of buying ivory carvings. That was big news several months ago when television cameras showed bulldozers in Guangzhou crushing tons of elephant tusks confiscated from smugglers. China's campaign continues with the broadcast of a public service announcement against poaching with former National Basketball Association player Yao Ming. The announcement shows the towering 7.5-foot-tall athlete looking down with sadness at a butchered elephant carcass on a Kenyan savanna. Brooke Darby says there should be more campaigns like China's in many countries. Darby is Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement, the U.S. agency that has taken on the poaching issue as a part of a global crime wave.
I think we focus a lot on the problem of demand being focused in Asia, but in fact, the United States is a major consumer of wildlife products, so we have some work to do here as well. We're right up there. One of the things that we've learned is that often consumers don't realize that the animal dies when the tusks or the horn are taken, and therefore these trinkets that they've picked up that are made of ivory actually result, you know, were a function of an animal dying in the field.
John Calvelli of the Wildlife Conservation Society says the United States is one of the largest users of ivory in the world. Probably, he says, one of the top five.
I will tell you, take a walk on the streets of New York, and you will find ivory for sale. And you realize studies have been done that show that probably about one-third of the ivory in the United States comes from illegally killed elephants.
John Webb is a former prosecutor of wildlife crimes for the U.S. Justice Department and a member of the President's Advisory Committee on Wildlife Crime. He confirms the United States is a huge market for ivory fueled by internet sales. For years, U.S. laws prohibited the sale of ivory taken from elephants killed after the CITES Treaty was signed in 1973. But it was difficult to tell the age of the ivory in a store window. Calvelli says there are efforts to pass a moratorium on all ivory sales in New York State. Greater impact may come from President Obama's announcement of a ban on all ivory sales within the United States. The new regulation, which prohibits the trade of any item that contains ivory of any age, is being criticized by antique dealers. If strictly enforced, it could end the sale of certain chess pieces, the handles of revolvers, letter openers, piano keys, and the bows of some violins. Since President Obama issued an executive order creating a 17-agency task force to combat wildlife trafficking, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has prosecuted several cases of black market trade in rhino horns. A Canadian art import and export firm doing business in Cameroon and the United States was fined $100,000 for shipping parts of 21 elephants to Ohio. The United States government has become a leader in international efforts to end poaching and the international shipment and sales of illegal ivory. The U.S. Agency for International Development has funded regional alliances of conservation and law enforcement agencies, such as Asia's Regional Response to Endangered Species Trafficking, or ARREST, in Bangkok, where there have been some successful busts. Webb has watched the growth of these regional networks with great interest.
Cops don't trust each other. I mean, that's the bottom line. And so one of the reasons why you create these wildlife enforcement networks is it's much easier to work with somebody who you've met face-to-face and know than it is some faceless law enforcement official from a foreign country.
More attention is being paid to judicial systems in African countries where wildlife crimes may not be punished. But Webb says government officials and the courts of many African countries represent the biggest challenge to the termination of the poaching of wildlife. However, the challenge of saving Africa's elephants is likely more complex than anyone yet realizes. Varun Vira is an analyst at C4 Ads and the co-author of Ivory's Curse, The Militarization and Professionalization of Poaching. Vera cites the work of the World Bank and others who draw a correlation between poaching and the long-term impacts of poverty, hunger, and infant mortality. Some of these observers note that poaching has been going on in Africa for centuries. I'm William Eagle in Washington. Put your flags up in the sky. In the sky.
Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAFootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAFootball.com.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa.
And still ahead, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from the continent, plus a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University.
It's now time for our Saturday Music Spot, so sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Your Rainbow Station, KMOD, FM 95, out of Wichita, Kansas, where the man says it's gonna be coming down all night. I hope you're warm and tight, honey. If you're feeling alone, baby, just get on the phone and talk to me. Just get on the phone, honey.
It makes me feel so special and so close to me. You know, he cheers me up. He makes me smile. He makes my life worthwhile.
Ugandan musician Eddie Kenzo, and that tune brings us to the end of our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. And now it's time for a Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Yang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Take it away, Dr. Yang.
Hello, Africa. This week, much talk took place around the forthcoming summit on Africa. This makes it categorically clear that as we move toward the summit, and you really want to understand how this summit is going to affect the president's legacy, this is why there must be a dialogue between these individual groups within the diaspora to talk together and then come to some understanding before the summit. Similarly, there must be a dialogue between them and the Black Caucus people, because the Black Caucus people are very much interested in Africa, and in their own way, they are doing what they can. But the most important thing really is the dialogue of the deaf must be meaningful. We have to change the tone. We have to change the relationship so that the African diaspora groups, and you have many of them, if you go by a country, how many Angolan ethnic groups are here, how many Algerians are here, is there different groups? And you can do that for every African group. So if you are talking about the summit and how you can get a dialogue between the political leaders on Capitol Hill, particularly the African diaspora, and the relationship between the African immigrant communities, we call them the African diaspora. It has many groups. You have African-Americans, Afro-Caribbeans, Afro-Latinos, African continental people are all here. And there are many organizations. We have to get these groups to come together so that they can help the Africans on the continent understand that there are serious efforts made so that at the summit, the president will deal with the African leaders at the highest level, but at the bottom level, the NGOs, consisting of many African diaspora groups and many interest groups with work going on in Africa. You have the religious communities, you have the NGOs that are very much interested in African affairs. All these groups are working towards this event. This leads me to the last point I want to make, and that is how this summit is going to affect the legacy of President Obama. Right now, if you are a student of legacies of recent American presidents, you can go back and look at Eisenhower. The Eisenhower Foundation, coming out from the Midwest, is actively involved in many domestic issues. They may deal with some international issues which link his legacy in Europe and how people working with him or his predecessor, Truman, are very much involved in German issues or illness issues. So when we talk about President Obama and his legacy, you can see the immediate impact of Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter. These are the more pressing legacies we have to pay close attention to. Jimmy Carter became more powerful and more influential as an ex-president than he was when he was president of the United States. So his legacies are very obvious now. He has a Nobel Peace Prize, and he has a foundation which is intimately involved in a number of things. So when you are looking for post-Obama legacy after his presidency, those who are interested in that legacy can see what has happened in the case of President Carter and what he has done with the Carter Foundation and the involvement of Carter in a number of local, national, and international issues. Habitat is one organization very much linked to him, and his legacy goes beyond Habitat, beyond the other groups. Bill Clinton's legacy is obvious. The Clinton Institution Foundation, which is very much involved in a number of issues in Africa. So when you look at the Clintons and the Carters on the one hand, and you look at the Bushes who are just beginning to look at what they're doing, I'm talking about George Bush Jr. and what his organization is trying to do. This is where legacy comes to mind. I think President Obama could do a number of things, building on what has been started in a number of areas. For example, he has a legitimate reason to engage Africa at many levels. I could see very well an Obama Foundation intimately involved with African countries, singularly and collectively. From Angola, for example, there should be serious attention devoted to the leadership in Angola and America, and they should be taken to higher levels. I can imagine how President Obama people can begin to look at all the individual African countries and make sure that they are more visible to their own willingness to cooperate with Africa. When you hear Japanese are giving 10,000 internships to Africa, the Obama people could double that number twice or three times because of the resources and the power of America. So when we talk about Obama's legacy, I can see many things coming up. And I think many people should pay close attention to that. Most importantly, the legacy of Obama is going to be more relevant when we have the summit, when the single things are going to be obvious in his relationship with all the African leaders. So when they go back, they have a lot of stories to tell their people. Never has the African continent witnessed someone of African descent in the White House. This is a very interesting moment, and they should make the best out of it. So I hope both of the continent and those on the American side will spend more time to prepare for this big moment, so that when people shake hands and say bye-bye, from the American side to the African side, and from the African side to the American side, and the African side going across the Atlantic, the legacy of the Middle Passage will have a new meaning this time around. The Africans came as slaves 500 years ago. Now they have an African-oriented person, somebody of African descent in the White House. So history has taken full course. When George Washington was at the White House, Africans were still slaves in this country.
That was Dr. Nyang. Thank you.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America.
Thanks for spending part of your Saturday with us. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
And I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Southern African nation of Malawi has achieved another peaceful transfer of power with the inauguration of Peter Mutharika as president on May 31st. Confirmed by the Malawi Electoral Commission as the winner of the May 20th election, he succeeds former President Joyce Banda, who congratulated Mr. Mutharika on his victory and urged all of her countrymen to give him their support. Mrs. Banda, concerned about allegations of possible improprieties, had requested a recount, but Malawi's High Court ordered release of the election results within the time limit prescribed by the country's electoral law. The polling was plagued by logistical problems and followed by sporadic protests, but an observer mission from the Southern African Development Community declared the election generally free, peaceful, and credible. The United States congratulates President Mutharika and the new Vice President, Saulos Chilima. We also congratulate the people of Malawi for actively and peacefully exercising their democratic rights. The peaceful transfer of power reflects the letter and spirit of their constitution. Its economy once teetering on the brink of collapse and its relations strained with many in the international community, Malawi made important progress under Mrs. Banda as president. Economic growth remains a concern, and President Mutharika has pledged to make it one of his top priorities. The United States looks forward to continuing our close partnership with the government of Malawi in advance of our mutual interests of supporting the nation's development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.